This is Community in Conversation with Kathy Kayla, starting conversations that matter.
Good morning. I'm Kathy Kayla. Thank you for joining me for this Community in Conversation. Listen to this. Around 275 million people used drugs worldwide in the last year of unprecedented upheaval caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. That's up by 22% from 2010. That's among the key findings of the latest annual report released in June by the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, which also provides an overview of global drug markets as well as their impact on people's health and livelihoods. Whether alcohol or drugs, as I understand it, substance abuse is always directly associated with pain, whether mental, emotional or physical. We are self-medicating and it is creating a mess. I wanted to understand more about pain, so I contacted pain science research fellow and research coordinator at Harvard Medical School, Dr. Marnon Robb. Good morning.
Hi, Kathy. Morning.
Thank you so much for the time. Dr. Robb, let's begin with some definitions. What is the difference between acute and chronic pain?
Firstly, call me Marnon. That would be better. That's a great first question, and I think that's a very crucial question and differentiation that people need to understand. So acute pain is when someone has literally just injured themselves and they still have tissue damage. There's definitely tissue damage that you can visibly see and sometimes not visibly see, but it lasts for 3 days. Some people say about 3 to 10 days, and you feel that pain while the tissue is healing. So acute pain is associated with tissue damage and the healing process. Chronic pain is when pain outlasts tissue healing. So basically, it's not associated as such with tissue damage more often. Rather, it's pain that is there present for 3 months or more by definition. People who experience pain for 3 months or more fit into the chronic pain category. And it's not necessarily related anymore to tissue damage. It's related more so to what's happening in the central nervous system and at a molecular level, and what's happening at a molecular level and how that's processing information. And we can get into more detail around that.
I would definitely like to understand how it works with the nerves and how we create damage to our nerve systems.
Sure.
There are apparently 4 types of pain. Can you tell us about them?
Well, I guess if we're going to differentiate different types of pain, you can have inflammatory pain, which is due to inflammation, tissue damage. You can have neuropathic pain, which is due to nerve injury. So a direct damage or direct injury on a specific nerve can cause neuropathic pain. Again, tissue damage or peripheral nerve pain is a result of damage to the tissue on a peripheral level, so outside the spinal cord or outside the brain, which is your central nervous system. Then you can have central sensitization, which fits into the chronic pain category, where the central nervous system processing, i.e. the spinal cord or the brain, has gone a little bit haywire or malfunctioning. And nociplastic pain, it also fits into chronic pain, or the way that the central nervous system and peripheral nervous system on a molecular level is processing information, and it's not processing information correctly. I like to not differentiate types of pain. I think it's important to differentiate mechanisms of pain and what's contributing to a person's pain experience, rather than defining the type of pain, but rather through diagnostics and having a very good pain clinician diagnosing the mechanism of the pain in order to treat the pain is what's really important, and not just sucking your thumb and saying, okay, well, I'm just going to give someone an anti-inflammatory because they're experiencing pain. They might not have inflammation. It's not really going to make a difference. So really identifying the source and the mechanism of the pain is really what the most important to do to manage pain.
Let's look at the physiology for a minute. What actually happens in our body? Say we take a pin and we prick our finger.
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to answer that question by asking a question almost. And this is a question I ask every patient that I see that comes to me with chronic or complex pain that's gone to everyone else, and I'm always the last person that they come and see. Or it's a question I generally ask initially to students that I'm teaching, at university level, or other healthcare providers that I teach at conferences or in CPD seminars. And the first question I ask them is, what is pain? And a question that sounds seemingly simple tends to be seemingly difficult, because actually, to actually define what pain is really difficult. Everyone comes up with a completely different idea or definition of what pain is. Some people will say pain is, oh, it hurts. Some people will say, oh, there's something dangerous happening. But there's no one set definition that every single student or every single patient or every single healthcare provider will come up with, which is telling us that it's a really complex definition, and it's a complex mechanism or complex mechanisms that take place in our body. And I'm going to further, before I answer your question, I actually want to just provide you with the International Association for the Study of Pain, their definition of pain. And they're the main body that really kind of looks into pain research and definitions of pain and all that type of stuff. And I'm going to read it to you because I think it's crucial to understand this before I actually explain what's happening at a nerve level or at a molecular level when we prick our finger, for example. Okay, so I'm going to read it to you. And the International Association for the Study of Pain defines pain as an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with or resembling that associated with, now this is important, actual or potential tissue damage. That's important. Actual or potential tissue damage. That means that you don't actually have to have tissue damage to feel pain. It could be a likelihood or anticipation of tissue damage to feel pain. Right. So that's why I just want to kind of first give you that definition. Well, then how can that happen?
That is the craziest thing that I've ever heard, that you could actually respond to pain based on your body's potential for pain rather than actually feeling it.
Correct. So that's definitely telling us that there's some sort of central process happening or brain involvement happening that is saying, okay, cognitively in your brain, based on culture, based on previous experiences with pain, based on anticipation, based on how you've seen family members experience pain, that contributes to the pain experience or the pain perception. And I always talk about pain as a pain perception or pain experience, because it's so differently experienced from me to you or you to someone else. It's an experience. It's a perception. So to answer your question, if I take a pin and I prick my finger, okay, or I prick your finger, firstly, what happens is there's tissue damage. Evidently, there has to be some sort of tissue damage, right? But the first thing to know is we do not have pain nerves in our body. There's no such thing as pain nerves, which most people get wrong, okay? People say, oh, well, my pain nerves are firing and that's why I'm feeling pain. That's incorrect. There's no such a thing as pain nerves in our body. We have nerve fibers called nociceptors. And what nociceptors are, specialized nerves, okay? They're not pain nerves. They are specialized nerves that fire a message from the periphery, i.e. from the finger, okay, where I've just pricked your finger or my finger, to the spinal cord, okay, and then up to the brain, right? And all that that message is sending up to the brain is, hey, there is tissue damage, there is inflammation, there's bleeding, there's something dangerous or noxious happening to my body, right? And it's up to your brain to decide what you do with that. Do you experience pain and take that needle out of your finger, okay, which would be a good response because you want to protect your body from further damage. And that's what acute pain is really, really important for. It's protective, right? So if you're running and you fall and you twist your ankle, the first thing you do is you get up, you lift your ankle and you protect it because you don't want further damage happening, right? So acute pain is really, really protective and very good. We want that. So what happens? You poke your finger with a pin, right? You get the nociceptors, which are not pain nerves, sending a message to the brain saying there's danger or there's tissue damage or there's inflammation. What are you going to do with this? And based on your past experiences or knowledge around tissue damage, the output from the brain is pain. That's your pain experience. Okay. So pain is not an input into the body. Pain is an output from the brain. So I always say no brain, no pain. If you didn't have a brain, you would not experience pain. You need your brain to understand, is this threatening to my body or is this not threatening to my body? And in an acute state of pain, it is threatening to your body. So a good working or a very functional central nervous system and peripheral nervous system will say, take that pin out quickly, feel pain because we need to protect your body. But a malfunctioning nervous system does not do that. And that's what happens in chronic pain.
Does the brain have pain receptors? How does the brain translate that this is pain?
Great question. So the brain as tissue itself has actually no nociceptors. Okay, so I'm going to use the word nociceptors. There's no such a thing as pain nerves. The brain has no nociceptors. If, for example, you think about Hannibal Lecter, and we won't go into horrific details around that, and there's this one scene where he's cutting someone's brain, the person doesn't feel pain, right, through cutting the brain tissue. There's no nociceptors in the brain. But what's happening is the message that is being sent from the finger up to the brain is firing in different parts of the brain that is responsible and for interpreting the message that's being sent from the periphery. Okay. So there is not one center in the brain that is responsible for interpreting the message from the nociceptors that are going up to the brain. I call it a pain matrix or pain neuromatrix. There's so many areas in the brain, hundreds of areas that are responsible for interpreting that message to have an output eventually of this is pain, move that needle away straight away. Okay. Specifically, there's areas in the brain responsible for the motive component or the affective component, like the limbic system, very much involved in pain processing. So how much anxiety do you have in relation to having your finger just pricked, right?
A lot.
The memory components, a lot, right? How many, like, people are so scared of having injections, right? What is the memory system like in the brain in relation to had an injection in the past? The hippocampus, for example, very much responsible for processing in the brain. And all these areas in the brain talk to each other and they have a network. It's like a neural matrix. And basically at the end of all the areas in the brain talking to each other, in response to this noxious, maybe innoxious stimulus, right? The output will be pain or no pain.
What I find absolutely fascinating is the way that you are describing it and how pain is defined. That means that emotional pain is actually a very real pain. Mental pain is a very real pain, right up there on the same level as a pinprick, a smack on the head, whatever it is.
Yes. So it's a good thing to bring up. And what I want to differentiate is when I try and teach patients, and I really do this about the pain processing in chronic pain, specifically in chronic pain. I'll get into that in a little bit more detail with you shortly, is that the pain, although I'm saying, is based on the brain and the output from the brain. It's not about the mind. A lot of people get scared and say, oh, you don't believe me, it's in my head. Like, yes, it's in your head, but it's in the brain tissue. The way that the processing and the wiring is happening in the brain, it's not about, oh, it's in your mind, you're making it up, because I believe that you've got pain. What I'm saying is that anxiety, depression, all these heightened emotions associated with pain can increase the pain experience. There is no evidence in the literature to say that anxiety and depression causes chronic pain. No evidence. However, there is major evidence to say that anxiety, depression, fear, all these strong emotions, right, that might be as a result of pain or might be a comorbidity with the pain, right, contribute to the overall pain experience and sensitize the nervous system even more. So I never say that someone is making up pain or, like, you know, it's in the mind, that type of thing. All these things really contribute to the pain experience. And so when you're managing someone with chronic pain, you've got to manage anxiety. You've got to manage depression. You've got to manage all these emotive factors to manage the patient fully to desensitize the nervous system. And I know I'm using the word sensitize and desensitize and central sensitization quite a lot, because that really refers to the mechanisms underlying chronic pain. And I can get into that with you if you would like me to.
There's so many questions around this. For example, when we take medication for pain, how do they work?
Excellent. Depending on what the pain mechanism is, and unfortunately, there's a huge statistical quantity of practitioners, healthcare practitioners, that don't really understand pain neuroscience. And it's a very specialized area of expertise. And from my side, I've specialized in this for many, many years. I did a master's, PhD in pain neuroscience for many years. And without understanding the mechanisms underlying the pain, it's very hard to actually prescribe a drug that really works on that particular mechanism underlying the pain. So, for example, if someone has inflammatory pain and there's definitely inflammation in the area where the person is feeling pain.
Give us an example.
An acute injury. So, pinprick. Or I put my hand on the stove, right? It's burnt. There's definitely tissue damage. There's definitely going to be inflammation. I'm going to want to prescribe an anti-inflammatory for that patient to reduce the inflammation. But I'm not going to want to prescribe an anti-inflammatory, this is my notion, and there's debates around this, in the first 2 to 3 days after an injury, because our body needs inflammation to heal. So what is the point of prescribing an anti-inflammatory in the first 2 to 3 days when you actually want inflammation in the body? If the inflammation outlasts its need, then you prescribe an anti-inflammatory to reduce the inflammation, which is contributing to the patient's pain. Now, if based on the assessment with the patient, you pick up that the patient has neuropathic pain, which we spoke about earlier, damage to the actual nerve, you're going to want to prescribe a medication that works on nerve damage, neuropathic pain. So, for example, a lot of people are on pregabalin or gabapentin, Lyrica, I'm sure you've heard of Lyrica, and Neurontin. Those two drugs are actually anti-epileptic drugs, but we use it in different dosages for neuropathic pain. Okay, so specifically for neuropathic pain, we would prescribe those type of drugs. Now, opioids, you're going to get into that, I know. Opioids are excellent pain killers when the pain is based on problems in the central nervous system processing, i.e., like we've discussed with chronic pain, a malfunctioning of the central nervous system. And an opioid works on the central nervous system and reduces pain on a central nervous system level, the spine and brain level. Now, the question is, if I'm in acute pain and really what's happening is the pain is a result of inflammation, it's peripherally based, there's no central sensitization as a result of chronic pain, should I be prescribing an opioid in those circumstances? My answer to you is no, because it's not based on central mechanisms of pain. It's based on peripheral mechanisms. However, when should an opioid be prescribed? You can ask. Well, if someone has chronic pain and you definitely know that there's a problem in the central nervous system on a molecular level, you will prescribe an opioid to reduce that pain, because everyone has the right to pain treatment. But you do not want people being on an opioid for too long, because obviously people can get psychologically and physically addicted to opioids, and opioids have a lot of side effects. So I often will suggest opioids for a short amount of time to reduce the pain in order to open doors up for other therapy. So to open doors up for maybe physiotherapy, psychotherapy, occupational therapy, and other forms of therapy, exercise therapy, for example. So we can manage the pain in other ways once we have reduced the pain with an opioid. But opioids for a prolonged period of time, well, we know the situation with the opioid pandemic. But I'm not anti-opioids when someone needs an opioid. It's how and when opioids are used.
When would someone need an opioid?
I would say if someone comes to me with chronic pain and based on my thorough initial evaluation, which generally my initial evaluation would be just talking to the patient for an hour, and understanding their pain processes. Just talking to a patient gives me an idea of the mechanisms underlying their pain. And I need to target the central nervous system and reduce the pain and desensitize the central nervous system using an opioid in order for them to be able to do other therapeutic modalities with me. So cognitive behavioral therapy, exercise therapy, and other things. I would say, okay, let's get you onto an opioid for 5 days. Let's reduce the pain. Let's open the door so we can do other things so that you can start self-managing your pain based on, I guess, what we come up with in terms of your goals. And I will work alongside you and steer the ship with you.
If you've just joined me, I'm Kathy Kayla. This is Community in Conversation. I'm speaking to Dr. Manan Rom. He's a pain science research fellow and research coordinator at Harvard Medical School. We are talking about pain because when you look at the statistics, you see that the world is self-medicating. It is absolutely massive. And whether you're talking about cannabis, whether you're talking about alcohol, whether you're talking about cigarettes, whether you're talking about opioids, you know, I think we're all aware of what's happening in the United States, tragically, with pain medications and with opioids. There's no doubt that we are in pain as humanity. So I thought we should learn more about pain. You mentioned earlier about depression. Is there a relationship between pain and depression, and which one causes which?
The chicken or the egg, right? There is no specific strong evidence in the literature. Being a scientist, and I look at evidence-based literature and I look at literature and science, there's no evidence that says that depression causes pain. Okay. However, if someone suffers from clinical depression or depression, okay, and they have an event that causes acute pain, or they have an event that causes chronic pain, that depression as a comorbid variable is certainly going to enhance the pain experience because of the neurotransmitters that are released with someone who has clinical depression, and also based on the person's experience with the pain. Generally, someone that is clinically depressed or depressed might have a heightened experience of that pain or have negative thoughts saying, this pain's never going to go away. Everything bad happens to me. Why me? All those type of thought processes or cognitions all happen in the brain. It's all about what's happening in the brain. And that's how I said to you that the brain is so important in terms of the output of pain and how people experience or perceive pain. So someone who's depressed can have a heightened pain experience versus someone who's not depressed. But does depression cause pain? No. Does depression heighten a pain experience? Maybe, or yes.
To oversimplify, and forgive me if I am oversimplifying, depression is caused by a shortage of serotonin and dopamine. Are serotonin and dopamine related to pain?
Absolutely, yeah. Pain is such a complicated neuroscientific symptom, and I'm not going to call chronic pain actually as a symptom. We believe chronic pain is now a disease of the central nervous system. And part of the mechanisms in neurotransmitters related to chronic pain and things that go wrong in the processing and things that go wrong is the release of serotonin. Sometimes it's too much serotonin released. Sometimes it's too little serotonin released. And so that's why sometimes people who experience chronic pain are often prescribed antidepressants as a tool to help reduce the pain. But the antidepressants are not prescribed as such for depression. They are prescribed to reduce the pain and some of the pain mechanisms. So we really dose it differently to someone when we're prescribing for depression. So a lot of people will be on trepiline or amitrepiline or Cymbalta. And those drugs are often used for people who suffer from depression. But in different dosages, we use it also as a pain tool to help reduce the pain experience for people who have chronic pain.
That's absolutely fascinating. What are the most surprising things that you've learned about pain?
So number one, that pain is not a sensory input into the body. It is, we do not have pain nerves. that pain is an output from the brain. Also, that pain needs to be managed through a biopsychosocial model.
What does that mean?
And what that means is it needs to be managed through using biological mechanisms, so sometimes pharmacologically, invasive intervention. We have to look at the biology. We have to look at the mechanisms psychologically. So if someone is really stressed or has a huge amount of anxiety due to the pain, we've got to manage the anxiety and depression or the psychological factors as well associated with the pain, because that's contributing to the pain experience, right? And socially, so biopsychosocial, socially, well, what has the pain done to this person? Have they now kind of limited their social experiences? Have they stopped going to the gym? Have they stopped going out for dinner with friends? Have they stopped seeing people socially because of their pain? So we need to get people back to recreational activities, back into society, back to work as quickly as possible to reduce the limitations of the pain perception and to improve people's overall quality of life.
How do different substances affect how our body interprets pain? So for example, let's look at alcohol. We know that South Africans have a very, very tricky and dangerous relationship with alcohol. Statistically, over 80% of crime is related to alcohol. We've got a very high death rate. People get stabbed. During the pandemic, when we were in lockdown, liquor stores were prohibited from selling. We saw people breaking into liquor stores because they had to get their hands on it. And it was more accessible than opioids.
Right.
What does alcohol do to our central nervous system?
Great question. It's definitely a numbing agent. It almost acts as your body's natural endorphin system. So it has an effect on how the output from the brain is responding to an experience or a noxious stimulus or an innoxious stimulus, right? So your body's, for example, your body's natural endorphins or your body's natural painkillers are 70 times stronger than any opioid drug that you can give. 70 times stronger. So if we have the ability to release our body's natural endorphins, right, painkillers, which we do actually have the ability to do through various techniques, we can talk about that.
Oh, we're definitely going to talk about that.
Yes. It's 70 times stronger than any opioid or morphine injection that you can get. Now, alcohol has that effect. Alcohol helps your body release its natural endorphins. That's how alcohol has a numbing effect, because it helps you release your body's natural endorphins. When you get slightly intoxicated or drunk, you get all happy and vibrant and things are good and the world is all good. Why? Because it is stimulating the receptors that release your body's natural endorphins. Now, that's a good thing, like maybe in the short term. Not good in the long term, right? Because we know obviously the side effects of alcohol abuse. But I don't want to get into the side effects of alcohol abuse, obviously physiologically and psychologically. But in the long term, if you have an injury or you have pain or chronic pain, let's say, and you're taking alcohol over and over and over, you're just masking what's happening on a neural or peripheral level. And you might be further injuring yourself if you've got acute pain or an acute injury or you've got chronic pain. So you're allowing your body to do too much, more so than it is capable of doing. So it's not going to be really good long term. The other important thing that I want to put out there is a lot of people have alcohol to numb the effect of pain after they've just injured themselves. So someone comes to me and they've sprained their ankle. They say, you know, can I have alcohol tonight? I'm sure that's going to numb the effect. I'm like, yes, it's going to numb the perception of your pain. However, the problem with alcohol is in acute pain. And if you've got inflammation in your body, alcohol increases inflammation in the body. So if you've just stubbed your toe, and you say, I'm going to go and drink, you know, BL2, and I'm going to just forget about my stubbed toe. The problem is that alcohol actually in the short term increases inflammation in the body. And so that stubbed toe is going to take much longer to heal.
Is that the alcohol working on our nervous system, or is that the sugar in the alcohol that's causing worse inflammation?
Both. So the alcohol working in the nervous system and the sugar causing worse inflammation. Absolutely.
You're lovely to interview. I'm just saying.
You're lovely to be interviewed by.
Let's look at other substances. Does cannabis work in the same way on our central nervous system that alcohol does?
Absolutely. So not in the same way exactly. It's a great question. We are all born with cannabinoid receptors. What are cannabinoid receptors? Cannabinoid receptors are receptors in our nervous system. So you've got a lock and key mechanism. That's how our nervous system works, through a lock and key mechanism. And the lock is the receptor. And the key is the neurotransmitter or chemical released in the body, or the chemical that we take through medication, right? Or cannabis has to open its specific lock, right? So the key or the chemical has to attach to its specific receptor or lock in order to activate it, in order to open the gateway to reduce pain or reduce other symptoms that you might be having. Now, we are born with cannabinoid receptors, which means that we should be having cannabis in our body. Why else would we be born with cannabinoid receptors in our body? Cannabinoid receptors are specific receptors that respond to cannabis. Now, if someone takes cannabis for pain, well, it needs to attach to something in order to have an effect. Cannabis attaches to our cannabinoid receptors, which has an effect on reducing pain as well. So just like alcohol has an effect on the central nervous system through attaching to its specific receptors, generally to the new opioid receptors, to the same receptors that opioids attach to, cannabis attaches to its own cannabinoid receptors, which has an effect on the descending pathways from the brain downwards. So the brain, after it's interpreted all the messages, has further heightening effect of reducing pain if you need to reduce pain through cannabis. So cannabis has its own receptors that cause a reduction in pain and a reduction in nausea and all the other things that people are using cannabis for these days.
Often you hear people, especially with cancer, how effective cannabinoids are in treating them with their pain.
Absolutely.
So now I understand why.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to again differentiate is that it's really only through really an informative evaluation and assessment that cannabis should be prescribed or suggested. Because once again, we've got to know in this person that's standing in front of me or sitting down in front of me when I'm assessing them and I'm treating them, person A versus person B versus person C versus person D might all come in with chronic lower back pain, right? However, based on the mechanisms through an assessment with them, I will know what is the right prescription, drug, medication to give them if they need medication based on my understanding of what mechanisms I play in their pain. Should they be prescribed cannabis or should they not, right? Should we do physical therapy with them? Should we do psychological therapy as well? So it's not one size fits all. And so cannabis might be effective for one person, but not for another, because their mechanisms might not need cannabis to help treat the pain. So I really want to put it out there that yes, cannabis is effective in treating pain, or pain that is related generally to central nervous system or chronic pain specifically.
If you've just joined me, I'm Kathy Kaler, and this is Community in Conversation. I'm speaking to Dr. Manan Rom. He's a pain science research fellow and a research coordinator at Harvard Medical School. We're talking about pain. We're talking about a global epidemic in pain, which is leading in turn to self-medication. Earlier this year, the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime put out the World Drug Report 2021. It is terrifying. Listen to some of these statistics. Cannabis is more potent, 4 times more potent now than it was in the 60s, but fewer young people see it as harmful. Web-based sales of drugs are on the rise and could transform global drug use patterns, which means this is another way that people are self-medicating. And as I said earlier on, is that self-medication comes from physical pain, mental pain, and emotional pain. A lot of people in emotional pain turn to alcohol because it just numbs everything. Alcohol consumption contributes to 3 million deaths each year globally, as well as to the disabilities and poor health of millions of people. Overall, harmful use of alcohol is responsible for 5.1% of the global burden of disease. What is burden of disease? It is what the cost is on healthcare systems. Some other statistics that came out. Collectively, smoking, alcohol, and illicit drug use kills 11.8 million people every year. Let me say that again. Smoking, alcohol, and drug use kills 11.8 million people each year. That's more than the number of deaths from all cancers. Isn't that just unbelievable?
It's a huge statistic that people should be very aware of. And just to be aware of, people that smoke, for example, and smoking, in terms of long-term side effects, we know what those are. You know, obviously cancer rates, stroke, so many long-term side effects. But the other big side effect of smoking, or people that smoke, is tissue healing. So smoking delays tissue healing. Anyone that smokes and damages tissue or hurts himself will have a much longer time recovering because they smoke versus people who don't smoke. So tissue healing is also delayed based on smoking. So if someone has an acute injury like we discussed earlier, that inflammation is going to last for much, much longer, and it's going to take a larger effort to get that pain under control.
What does smoking put into our body? And what does it do to our central nervous system that reduces pain?
Right. So smoking as such, I personally have never smoked. I've had one little puff and I didn't like it. Yeah, naughty. But smoking as such, you know, from what I hear, what people that generally smoke on an ongoing basis relaxes them, from what I know. So smoking, it's the nicotine that relaxes one, that plays a part on the central nervous system and relaxes you. And like I said, that if people are in pain and they're suffering from heightened anxiety related to their pain, you're smoking and you're putting nicotine into your body and it's acting on the central nervous system, that by itself is stimulating certain receptors that can have an effect on reducing pain or having an analgesic effect by itself. And it relaxes you, so it takes away some of that anxiety, which by itself, anxiety causes further sensitization of the nervous system and increases pain. So if you're relaxing yourself and reducing the amount of cortisol levels and adrenaline in your body due to stress or anxiety, well, certainly smoking is going to have an effect on reducing pain in the short term, right there and there for a minute or however long you feel relaxed after smoking. But it's certainly not going to have a long-term effect on reducing pain.
Is there ever a relationship between mental health or mental state rather than mental health and pain?
So the relationship between the two. Yeah, absolutely. The more anxious you are, we know about stress physiology. So for example, the more stressed you are and for the prolonged period of time that you might be stressed, when you are stressed, your body's releasing cortisol, right? So your adrenal glands are releasing a lot of cortisol in your body, which acts as almost cortisone. And when you're stressed, your body's releasing a lot of adrenaline. So the more stressed or anxious you might be, the more pain you might experience, because cortisol in the long term and adrenaline in the long term acting on the central nervous system further sensitizes the nervous system, and that will increase your pain experience even more. So we've got to look at stress physiology. We've got to look at anxiety when treating pain, because like I said, heightened stress, heightened anxiety will increase the pain experience. And again, that's why using an interdisciplinary approach to managing pain, or a biopsychosocial approach to managing pain, is so critical. critical. And that's what I use, obviously, in pain treatment, is an interdisciplinary approach.
Earlier you mentioned that our own endorphins are 70 times more effective than any painkiller that any pharmaceutical company can make. How do we tap into that so that we can stop self-medicating?
Great question. So how do we actually feel happy? When you're exercising, and a certain amount of exercise specifically, it's not just like saying, I'm going to walk on the treadmill for 1 minute, or I'm going to go lift weights for 10 minutes. A certain amount of exercise for specific pain conditions, and sometimes you have to differentiate those pain conditions or pathologies, require a certain type of exercise or specific amount of exercise. Exercise needs to be looked as a prescription when it comes to pain, not just going and exercising. A certain amount of exercise and type of exercise releases your body's natural endorphins. That's why everyone says when they go to the gym, when they exercise, they feel happy and they feel good. So when you are exercising, you're releasing your body's natural endorphins, which make you feel happy and also act on the opioid receptors in your body, which like I said, are 70 times stronger than any morphine injection that you can have. That's one way. So exercise. Wonderful. Get happy. Get exercising. But be right with the exercise. It needs to be prescribed specifically if you're suffering from chronic pain. It's not, again, one size fits all. Okay. Number two, things like TENS machines. I'm sure a lot of the listeners, maybe you, Kathy, have heard about TENS machine that's often used by physiotherapists and some nursing staff. So it's those small electrodes. You can even buy them in the pharmacy. I have a few problems with that myself, but the TENS machine is an electrotherapy unit, small little unit, battery operated that has electrodes attached to it. And you attach those electrodes onto areas of your body, sometimes over where the pain is felt or away from where the pain is felt. And on the right frequency settings by a practitioner or clinician, facilitates your body's natural endorphin release. And again, if you facilitate your body's natural endorphin release through, for example, an electrotherapy modality such as TENS unit, again, that could be 70 times stronger than taking a morphine or morphine injection, no morphine tablets or capsule. That's just two examples. There's ways to get your body to release its natural endorphins, but you need sometimes a prescription from someone that knows what they're doing to allow you to do that and do it in the right way.
What I'm hearing you say is that you need somebody who's going to help you manage it.
And that's pain management. So being a pain management specialist, I always say I'm your navigator. I'm going to hold your hand through this path. I'm going to help you self-manage your pain. I can't promise I'm going to take your pain away. If you've got chronic pain, you've probably got chronic pain. You're going to have pain for the rest of your life. But I'm going to help you get back to doing the things you used to do, despite the fact that you've got pain. And hey, if we can reduce some of that pain, great. That's wonderful. And we will be able to reduce some of the pain. Okay, let's achieve the goals that you set out, not that I set out. What do you want to be able to do again, despite the fact that you've got pain, that you've stopped doing because of your pain?
Obviously, bearing in mind that certain pains will need surgery to fix. And, you know, if you think about the lumbar, if you're looking at lower back pain, because apparently that's a big issue with many, many people around the world, is lower back pain. I think it's the number one form of pain.
Yeah, so lower back pain is one of the world's foremost causes of disability in the world, foremost causes of days lost from work, and really people that just don't get back to work. And lumbar spine pain or lower back pain is one of the foremost causes of that. Again, what is the cause of the lumbar pain or lumbar spine pain? Yes, someone might need to have surgery. There might be spinal stenosis. There might be nerve root impingement. There might be a cyst there. So you've got to really find the mechanisms and causes of the pain. And definitely a large proportion of patients might have to have surgery to reduce the pain. But how many people come back with the same pain after they've had surgery? Failed surgery, call it failed lower back surgery, for example. They've had 5 lower back surgeries, but they still have pain. That's telling us that the pain is no longer about what's happening on an anatomical level anymore. Something happening in the processing of the central nervous system. And I use this metaphor a lot with patients so they understand what's happening. Most people with their cars or their homes have an alarm system. And what's that alarm system in your car or your house for? It's there to warn you that there is danger. But you need a specific stimulus to make that alarm system go off. So let's stick to the house alarm system. If you set your alarm system and it's working beautifully, you go to sleep at night, someone crashes a window or breaks down a door, that alarm's going to go off. It's working well. It's good. You want that to happen. It's warning you of danger. That's wonderful. That's good. You want that. Okay. What happens if that alarm system is faulty? So faulty would be, well, it's going off to stimuli that it shouldn't be going off to. So now there's just a drop of water on the door handle or on the window. And now this alarm system's going off. That's a problem. That's a faulty alarm system. It's warning you of danger or harm to your household, to you, when there's no danger or household. So a small stimulus is now causing that alarm system to go off. There's a faulty processing. And that's exactly what happens in your body with the body's pain system. So a good pain system works like a good alarm system, right? So you need a specific stimulus or threshold of stimulus to cause the brain to say, hey, this is dangerous, experience pain, right? So you stub your toe, you put your hand on a hot stove, the pinprick example. That's a good alarm system. It's working well, right? But what happens in chronic pain is that that alarm system becomes faulty, just like that faulty alarm system in your house. People start experiencing pain with things that they shouldn't be normally experiencing pain. So someone with chronic back pain, for example, now starts feeling pain when they go from sit to stand. That's a normal functional activity. You should not be feeling pain. When they're just walking in the shops, those are normal activities. You should not feel pain. If someone just touches their lower back without great pressure, they start feeling pain. Those are innoxious, we call stimuli, that should not cause pain. Your body's alarm system or pain system becomes faulty, just like a faulty alarm system in your house or your car. And that equals central sensitization. So when I'm talking about sensitization of the nervous system, I'm really talking about that faulty alarm system. And that faulty alarm system can become more and more sensitized the more you don't treat your pain properly, or the more you don't have your pain properly managed by a good professional or good pain clinician.
So interesting. I also have an analogy, and I think that it's how we have been approaching pain when one looks at the statistics of self-medicating, either through alcohol, substance abuse, whatever it is. You're driving your car and your brake light goes on. So you take it off to the mechanic, and the mechanic says, don't worry, we'll just cut the wire to the brake light. Instead of dealing with the actual issues, we're just cutting that alarm brake light. And I think that it's that we are not progressing because of it.
Absolutely. So that's a great analogy. And so a lot of people will say, well, why don't we just correct that faulty alarm system? Well, that faulty alarm system is faulty not because of one process. It's faulty because of many mechanisms along that wiring.
And it's holding up your house.
Exactly. There's many things we've got to kind of look at, right? So just prescribing one drug or doing just one thing is just targeting one mechanism. We've got to look at the person as a whole. And again, going back to that biopsychosocial model, we can't just treat a person with chronic pain just using a drug or an opioid. We've got to really look at the whole mechanism underlying the patient's pain system or their pain perception or their pain experience to be able to help the patient manage their pain.
Absolutely fascinated. I have enjoyed speaking to you so much. Thank you so much for making the time. Just a question. When you say
yes.
That you speak to patients, do you actually consult? I mean, you're a fellow at Harvard Medical School. You lecture. How are you finding time to see patients?
So, I mean, I consulted for about 20 years, and yes, I've limited a little bit my consultation times, but I do consult through Zoom often. I do a few consultations a week. I do set aside time. a little bit of time for clinical work and consultations. So people all over the world, I do Zoom consultations with actually. And so if anyone does want a consultation or needs some navigation in terms of where to go with their pain, who should they see, I do Zoom consultations still. So
Dr. Manan Ram, Pain Science Research Fellow and Research Coordinator at Harvard Medical School, thank you so much for your time.
It's been a pleasure and thank you for having me. I've loved speaking to you.
Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you. You too.
Pain Science Research Fellow and Research Coordinator at Harvard Medical School, Dr. Manan Ram. In conclusion, sometimes it's good to zoom into issues, understand the mechanisms behind them, while at other times it's necessary to zoom out in order to see the bigger picture. I hope that this week you have a better understanding of pain. If you find that you are self-medicating, give our helpline a call. The Chai FM helpline is a free service. It is absolutely confidential and it is anonymous. That number is 0800 24 24 36. I wish you and yours a Shabbat Shalom, dear friends. God bless, and I'll be back next week. This is Kathy Kaler for Community in Conversation on 101.9 Chai FM.
It's a Community in Conversation. Join Kathy Kaler every Friday at 9 a.m. for Community in Conversation. Be brave enough to start a conversation that matters. Right here on 101.9 Chai FM.